When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey folks, it's Forrest and Scott from the Astonishing Legends podcast. We just found out that Mint Mobile has come out with an amazing wireless deal for this holiday season.
If this was an episode of our show, I'd think this was a myth. It's too good to be true. But the thing is, like some of the legends we cover, this deal is true. Right now, when you switch to Mint Mobile and buy any 3-month plan, you'll get another 3 months for free.
I'm not sure how they're able to do this. Oh wait, I do know how they can do it. They're online only. No stores, no traditional retail costs. Mint Mobile passes that savings to you. That's unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed data delivered on the nation's largest 5G network.
Like we say on our show, sometimes the unbelievable is true, and this deal proves it. Switch to Mint Mobile now and get premium wireless service starting at just $15 a month.
And you can use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan. Keep your same number and all of your contacts.
That's right, listeners. For a limited time, buy any 3-month Mint Mobile plan and get 3 more months free by going to mintmobile.com/wireless.
That's mintmobile.com/wireless.
Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/wireless.
So what was your favorite part of the holidays?
Really?
You sure?
Okay. And Disneyland? You liked that? When we went there? It was okay.
Okay.
And Vietnam with the snorkeling and the helicopter ride. No. Vast landscapes of wondrous scenery didn't do it for you. No, your favourite thing was Radio Wolfgang. Huh. Well, what's that? The app? You really like the Radio Wolfgang app? Huh. Okay, cool. And the hotel? No, that wasn't your favourite? Still, yeah. It's just, you're only 5 years old. You sure Radio Wolfgang was your favourite thing? And getting ice cream. Right. The Radio Wolfgang app and ice cream. Great. Good summer.
The definition of the deep sea depends on who you talk to, but the biology ecology community seems to be circling around 250 meters. I like to think I'm in the deep sea when I can't see sunlight, I can't detect sunlight anymore, which is usually about 500 meters.
Take it in.
It is actually the BIS, for the first time, allowed the general public to be exposed to liquid breathing and the concept of liquid breathing. And in my opinion, a lot of people got the impression that it was science fiction, because of the fact that there was also a subplot related to aliens living under the sea.
That's it. Oh, man. Don't hold your breath now. Take it in. There you go. Don't hold your breath. Take it in. That's it. There you go.
What?
Perfectly normal. We all breathe liquid for 9 months, bud. Your body will remember. That's it.
I find what divers do absolutely fascinating physiologically, equally scary and equally exciting, but I don't think anyone would be under any illusion it is a dangerous sport, and certainly when people are pushing themselves to those extremes, it's very difficult to predict what the body is going to do, and obviously they're a long way from help on the deepest part of that dive.
Baby, breathe. Come on. Five.
It's all over, man. It's all over. I'm sorry.
No pulse.
Hello, and welcome to Science-ish, which does have a pulse. I'm Rick Edwards. I'm joined, as ever, by Dr. Michael Brooks.
Hello.
Have you got a pulse, Michael?
I do have a pulse, yes.
I'm never too sure when I look at you. So, you know how this works by now. We look at a piece of fiction, a film, or, I mean, a film, really. Sometimes a book, but usually
never
a film.
Never a play.
Absolutely. We did, when we first talked about this show, we were like, we could do plays as well, couldn't we? And everyone sort of went, maybe. Sorry, playwrights and theatre goers. I don't enjoy the theatre. I find it really dull.
That's controversial.
I honestly, when the interval comes, I'm like, I've got to go back in there. Fuck off. The thing is, theatre seats are tiny. I don't fit in them. I'm just like, nah.
No, sometimes there's great stuff on at the theatre.
Go on, name me one.
I went to see a thing, last thing I saw was about 2 years ago, called The Nether.
So you obviously love it.
Yeah, yeah.
Point being, we pick a film or a book, and then we look at the science within it. And then we ask 3 questions and try and answer them with the help of some experts. This is now our 13th episode, and we've gone from outer space with our alien episode last time to an equally alien landscape, the deep sea.
Here's a bottomless pit, baby. 2.5 miles straight down.
And so we've gone with, because apparently we love James Cameron here, his 1989 sci-fi hit, The Abyss.
It was alive. It was like a dance of light. It was the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. I don't think they mean us any harm. I don't know how I know that.
When was the last time you watched The Abyss, / have you seen The Abyss?
So I have seen The Abyss, and I saw it yesterday.
First time?
First time.
See, I watched it, I think I was about 14 or 15. And to be fair, it might also be one of those films where I didn't make it all the way to the end.
That wouldn't surprise me.
It's quite long, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I know the general gist of it. So maybe I'll sort of do my plot summary and then you pick up with your more recent expertise.
Director's cut.
An American submarine sinks.
Yeah.
Some Americans and some Soviets try and go and rescue it. There's like a drilling base, is it?
Yeah.
Or exploration.
Just nearby.
Nearby they use as their kind of hub of operations. And then they go down and try and get this sub and then, oh dear, there's some aliens.
Some weird shit happens, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
And people start seeing things and you know.
It's all sort of like blurry lights and stuff like that at first, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. But the problem they've got is that it's a nuclear-equipped submarine, so they send these Navy SEALs down with them, and their job is to kind of secure the nuclear warheads. Basically, you've got Navy meatheads deep under the ocean being idiots and trying to blow shit up, and the divers have to then, you know, try and stop them.
Mm. we're going to sort of avoid all of the alien stuff.
Good job, this, too, because they're terrible aliens. They are the wettest, pun intended, the wettest aliens you've ever come across.
But we're going to, so we're leaving the aliens well alone. I think we can sort of do a quick summary. Are there aliens living under the sea, Michael?
In real life, you mean?
In real life.
Almost certainly not.
Almost certainly not. That's good enough for me. We are going to focus on the water side of it, though. This was, by all accounts, an absolute nightmare to film, wasn't it?
Yeah, apparently. So a couple of the characters had real big emotional breakdowns. Ed Harris nearly died during filming one of the scenes, apparently.
Yeah.
I think James Cameron said he'd never do that again.
Yeah. This film was inspired, weirdly, by some real science, wasn't it?
James Cameron went to a lecture when he was 17 years old that was by a guy called Francis Fajic. And he talked about experiments that were going on to kind of, you know, do liquid breathing. And Cameron was obviously just completely kind of hooked by this. You know, I expect that he'll have been inspired by other stories of aliens and, you know, various undersea exploits. But, you know, I think that apparently is when he decided to put the whole thing sort of together.
That's actually quite nice for science-ish. It's like the full circle. You have science and then you have fiction about that science, and now we do our show about the science in fiction.
And then one day somebody will do some science based on the things that we're about to reveal in this show.
I mean, I'm amazed it isn't already happening.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it is. The results haven't come out yet.
Ah, right, yeah. So this film, if you sort of ignore the aliens and actually also the Russians, it's about diving and humans going very, very, very deep into the ocean. So I think we should go really deep on our first question.
How deep do you want to go, Rick?
Well, I don't like it when you when you look at me and say that. But our first question is, how deep can humans go and what are the limiting factors? We asked the London Diving Chamber's Dr. Oliver Firth.
The limiting factors really come down to, A, how much oxygen the diver can store in their body. And that's really a function of how big their lungs are, how big a breath they take down with them, and also how quickly they use it up. So those things obviously require training to extend as much as possible. I think in terms of whether there will ever be limitless diving, really, I don't know how far we can push this. I find what divers do absolutely fascinating physiologically, equally scary and equally exciting, but I don't think anyone would be under any illusion it is a dangerous sport. And certainly when people are pushing themselves to those extremes, it's very difficult to predict what the body is going to do. And obviously they're a long way from help on the deepest part of that dive.
Go ahead.
There is a large component of the air that you're breathing is nitrogen, which is inert at the surface, but as you descend, it will dissolve into your blood and it gives you a sort of narcotic effect the deeper you go. So by about 30 metres, most people will notice that their thinking is perhaps slightly disturbed. It's typically a euphoric experience initially, but as you go deeper and deeper, it becomes more and more detrimental in terms of your thinking ability. You become perhaps more, you can't think straight, you become very, very intoxicated, start behaving erratically, sometimes paranoia, sometimes anxiety will kick in, and below about 50 metres we hear stories about people believing they're fish and taking their breathing apparatus out and drowning. So it becomes a very sort of dangerous thing to breathe below about 50 metres.
It's bad. It's wonderful.
It's me. No.
It's okay.
What is it? Is it alive? Lindsay, no.
Seawater.
Always remember, you are not a fish. Repeat, you are not a fish.
No, to be fair, I've only done...
Oh, do try and be fair, yeah.
I've only done scuba diving once, and I'm not sure that I would do it again. It was all right. But,
really?
Yeah, would you do it?
Yeah, I loved it. I've done it twice, and I found it absolutely...
I loved it while I was there, but it was a lot of work to go through all the theory. Half a day of theory.
I think I did it somewhere where they were a little bit more lax.
Oh, really?
And they were just like, let's get down there. Yeah. And I was like, great.
I think I did half a day of physics work, basically, about, you know, bubbles and nitrogen and pressures and everything else. And then, you know, we got down into the sea, and it was pretty amazing. But...
Too much like hard work to get down
there. It was a bit of hard work, yeah.
What happens when we're coming up? Because that's the bit where you get the old bends, isn't it?
Yeah. So that's when you get, if you come up too fast and the pressure goes down too quickly, then all the nitrogen that's around in your blood just bubbles out and causes bubbles within your tissues. And extremely painful.
Bad news.
Yeah, extremely painful, can lead to death.
That is painful.
Yeah. So that's the other thing about scuba diving for me, was there were a lot of things that I felt could lead to death.
I can't help but I'm scared.
So what's the world record depth, Michael? Michael. Hello, Michael? Michael thinks he's a fish.
So the world record depth is 1,090 feet, or 332.35 metres.
Uh-huh. You're not just reading that out, are you? You know that.
No, yeah, of course I know
that.
Okay,
good,
yeah,
good, good.
Yeah. And apparently the guy who did it spent more than 14 hours underwater.
It's taking a piss, isn't it?
Yeah.
What for? Get down there, set your record, get up again.
Well, you know.
Or is it that it just takes you a really long time to get back up?
It can't take
depth.
Oh, you mean the decompression thing?
Yeah,
I guess so.
God, that's tedious, isn't it?
That's the whole thing. The whole thing is tedious. I saw quite a lot when I was snorkeling, to be honest. I didn't see that much more.
I'm not saying that snorkeling is not good. Well, snorkeling's great.
Yeah.
But you do see more with scuba.
You do.
So this guy's gone down to over 300 metres. Presumably, you get further problems as you go further down, don't you?
Well, you get more and more gases crammed into your lungs. So if you come up too fast, for instance, you risk a pulmonary embolism, where the gas just expands and bursts your lungs like a balloon.
Oh.
Nasty. You get high-pressure nervous syndrome, which basically you're just losing everything. You've got dizziness, nausea, vomiting, tremors, fatigue. Your brain doesn't work as well.
You're having a nightmare.
You're basically, and you actually literally have nightmares afterwards. You have poor sleep with nightmares afterwards.
With all of these things, is the problem the bubbles? And if we get rid of the bubbles, then you kind of get rid of these issues.
Yeah.
So how do we get rid of them then?
We breathe liquids.
I mean, immediately, I want to say, no, we can't. But so I want that to be our second question. Can we actually liquid breathe? And we asked one of the field's pioneers, Professor Thomas Schaefer, exactly what liquid breathing is.
When we breathe gases like air, for example, the main purpose is to bring oxygen into the body. And when we breathe in air, only 21% of it is oxygen. So air uses nitrogen as a carrier for oxygen when we breathe air. However, it's also possible to breathe liquids which have a high solubility for oxygen. And in this case, these perfluoric chemicals have incredible solubility for respiratory gases. If you talk about something like saline or seawater, the solubility of oxygen in that is less than 1% volume basis. In other words, it's about 0.03 milliliters of oxygen can be dissolved in 100 milliliters of saline or seawater. On the other hand, if you talk about a perfluoric chemical, there's 30 volumes percent, or 30 milliliters of oxygen, which can be dissolved in every 100 milliliters. And that solubility, in fact, is even greater than the solubility of oxygen in blood. So these compounds can carry more oxygen and carbon dioxide than blood can carry. So it is possible then to breathe a liquid like a perfluoric chemical, and that concept is known as liquid breathing. And in fact, there's a page on Wikipedia that everyone refers to when they want to know something about liquid breathing.
Don't worry, we've gone there for you.
Yeah. Yeah, a little insight into the research that Brooksy does before every episode of Science Fiction.
I know, that's what I mean. Why would he give away my methods?
Sorry, mate, sorry. We'll cut that out, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So these perfluoro compounds, PFCs, there is more oxygen dissolved in them, or there can be, than there is in air or in our blood. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah.
That's pretty amazing. And then it just and then it just pops out.
So when you fill your lungs with it, the oxygen will naturally seep out effectively into your bloodstream.
And so has this been around for a while then? Have people been breathing this stuff in and, you know, going about their lives?
Well, not certainly not going about their lives, but we've been on it since the 1960s. There's various sort of experiments that were done. Of course, in the 60s, you could do fantastic experiments. And so we did it with a lot of animals. And
of course we did.
Yeah. So they found that in the first sort of set of experiments that rats could be in this stuff. You literally drop them into the liquid and they stay there, presumably hold them down to stop them swimming. And you leave them in there for 20 hours or so. And the problem is that you're fine once you're in there, but once you're out, you're screwed. So what didn't work?
Why is that?
Because your body actually can't, once it's out, get rid of all the kind of waste products that are produced through respiration. So you're in a position where you can stay in this liquid, and then they bring you out and you die.
Mm.
So that's not great.
But that's not ideal, is it?
It's not ideal. So we've done it, you know, humans have done it to a certain extent, but what we do is a thing called partial liquid ventilation,
right,
where you have sort of 40% normal air and 60% liquid. So you can get rid of the carbon dioxide that builds up.
In the way that you normally would, by breathing it out.
Yeah.
Right.
This is a means of actually helping premature babies, for instance, now. So this has been explored a lot, because if they're born too early, their lungs can't deal with air. They literally can't be held open. And so there's been experiments where they've tried to help very, very premature babies to breathe by filling their lungs with liquid.
Oh, wow. How do fish get on then? What's their mechanism? Because they're sort of doing a bit of liquid breathing in a way, aren't they?
Yeah, they have gills that are able to separate out oxygen from the water.
And so can't we do something similar?
Well, we've tried, but we haven't managed to make any technology that does this. Not in the way that's efficient enough for us to breathe it, no.
Oh, so we could do it, but the energy costs would be too great, would it?
Actually, there's a group in at the University of Southern Denmark who developed a crystal that they say, you know, can absorb a massive amount of oxygen, and you just stick this in your mouth and then you'll get oxygen coming out of it. But it's a kind of prototype, doesn't really work properly. But, you know, if we could make an artificial gill, it'd be brilliant.
Fish are absolutely nailing it, aren't they?
Yeah.
The fish have got no problems.
But it's one of those things that evolution has solved and we haven't managed to reproduce.
A bit embarrassing for us. So can humans use this liquid breathing for diving then?
To a very limited extent. One of the problems is that if you have loads of liquid in your lungs, you lose a lot of heat very quickly as well. So basically, no, we haven't managed to get liquid breathing really working yet.
I mean, it sounds horrendous. I've got liquid in my lungs and it's bloody freezing.
Yeah.
No, thank you.
The actual discovery of liquid breathing was rather serendipitous. A colleague of mine, Leylin Clark, was working with these perfluoric chemicals and knew that they had the capability of dissolving large amounts of oxygen and carbon dioxide from a chemistry perspective. And he was in the laboratory and he had the liquid in front of them. And he had these cages of mice around the laboratory. And he got one of those aha moments thinking, well, what if I were to put this mouse into the liquid and allow them to breathe on their own the liquid? And lo and behold, he did that experiment. And the mouse breathed the liquid for about 15 minutes. And he took the mouse out, and it was perfectly fine. And then he took that one step further in doing the diving experiments, where he took a mouse and took various animals to great depths, and they were breathing liquids rather than gases. And he showed that when they breathed the liquids, they didn't have any decompression sickness when they came to the surface rapidly. So that was the start of that it could be done.
Excuse me. is all this stuff?
Fluid breathing system. We just got them. You use it when you go really deep.
How deep?
Deep.
How deep?
It's classified. Anyway, you breathe liquid so you can't get compressed. The pressure doesn't get you.
You mean you got liquid in your lungs?
Oxygenated fluorocarbon emulsion.
Bullshit.
Check this out. Can I borrow your rack?
What are you doing?
Hey, no.
You're gonna kill her!
It's okay, I've done this myself.
Oh, man, like, what are you, just drowning her?
She's gonna be fine. I breathed this myself. Gonna be fine.
No, man, she's gonna drown. Look, she's freaking out.
Just going through a normal adjustment period.
Normal? Does this look normal to you? She's gonna drown.
He's taking the fluid into his lungs. There he goes. So there's a bit of anxiety here. Now he's starting to relax. He's breathing fine. See his chest moving? Getting plenty of oxygen.
Damn rat's breathing that shit. That is no bullshit, hands down, the goddamnest thing I ever saw.
See, the fluid's harder to push in and out than air. It's a little more work to breathe. But he's doing fine. He's digging it.
She's doing it. She ain't digging it. All right, let her out. Now. Now!
Okay, all right. Okay, now we let the fluid drain from his lungs.
All right, give it here.
There's a rat. See, he's fine. It's a sheep.
There have been discussions by Navy SEALs who are not allowed to speak in public or acknowledge any of this work. But I have spoken to Navy SEALs who have claimed that they did this. And because they did it so long ago, I had asked them to speak at a conference to tell us about their experiences, and they said that they were not allowed to speak publicly about any of this, but they were perfect examples of someone who had been exposed under very severe conditions at great depths and had survived.
Okay.
Relax now, bud. Just relax.
Bud.
Relax now, bud. Relax.
Okay, watch me.
Okay, doing fine. Now, don't hold your breath. Take it in. Just let yourself take it in. That's it.
Oh, man.
Don't hold your breath now. Take it in. There you go. Don't hold your breath. Take it in. That's it. There you go.
What? That's not normal.
It'll pass in a second. It's perfectly normal.
It's perfectly normal.
We all breathe liquid for 9 months, bud. Your body will remember. That's it.
Do you think they've gone down and done that?
All military technology eventually becomes public technology, doesn't it? And
yeah.
And I think that we'd have known about that. It solves too many problems, doesn't it? If you could do it.
There's not really any reason to keep it to yourself either, is there? You make a lot of money.
I refuse to believe that we can do liquid breathing commercially and we haven't exploited it, because I know a lot of people who would pay for that.
Yeah, not you, though.
Not me, no.
Just happy with your snorkel. So the bit in the film where the rat is liquid breathing, that's happened.
So that has happened, yeah. But they die afterwards at some point.
Well, he said that the mouse was fine.
Yeah, I think it wasn't fine for very long.
I also think that back in the day, they did not give a shit.
They got it out, it was still breathing, and that was it.
And then shuts it back into its cage.
Exactly, yeah. Didn't notice that it died 3 minutes later.
Let's say for a moment that we can do liquid breathing and with like total liquid ventilation. Why would that be better than normal scuba then? What's it doing for us?
You don't get the bubbles, basically. So you don't get the decompression sickness. You don't get the problems with that.
And what else do I need to take down? Like, if I'm getting chilly, do I need some sort of artificial heater on me as well?
Yes, you would.
That's quite a lot of stuff to take down, isn't it?
Yeah, it's best to stay on the surface and look down with your snorkel.
Right, well, that's not what we're talking about on this episode of Science-ish, Michael. We're talking about the abyss, and it was deep.
Yeah, and you wouldn't see me down there.
If I was down there liquid breathing at like 500 metres and the only thing I saw was you, I'd be like, I see this in the studio every week. I don't need it down here as well.
No, it's all right because it'd be quite dark.
You giving me the thumbs down.
Yeah. This is shit.
Should we go back up? I'm getting cold. if we are able to nail this technology, then that like the limits of human diving would be massively increased.
Yeah,
they?
Yeah.
We'd be going down very deep.
Yeah, we'd be like the deep sea fish, wouldn't we?
We could get down really, really far, and then I'm wondering, what am I seeing down there? And that is our third question. What would we find? And we asked Professor Cindy Lee Van Dover of Duke University.
The scale at which we know the deep ocean depends on who you talk to. If you talk to a geophysicist or geologist who's mapping the seabed topography, we know that pretty well now. But as a biologist, I would say, you know, very, very little of the seafloor has been explored. We've gotten better. Our access has improved over the decades. I started in the 1980s, was my first cruise where I was working with submersibles, and there are very few of us who are doing this, and not many vehicles or countries that had access. Now every country who wants a tethered vehicle can lower it down and take a look at what's happening on the seafloor. But think about a vehicle where you have video cameras, you're looking through water where light penetration doesn't go very far, you're really looking at little pinpoints on the seabed. And when we plot them on the maps, they look like big icons, right? You go to Google Earth and you drop your little point, and it looks like you've covered the whole map because there's all these little points, but they're really just tiny square meters of seabed, or you know, maybe sometimes a kilometer or two strip a couple of meters wide that we've looked at. And I think we're still right about less than 0.01% of the seafloor has been looked at the level where we can see the biology or sample the biology. Life on the seafloor depends upon which part of the seafloor you're talking about. It is not a homogeneously uniform world. A large part of the seafloor is soft sediment, and there's lots of species in the sediment, so it's very diverse. But the biomass is very small, and the number of individuals is relatively small. So it really takes a specialist to get excited about them, little nematodes, little bivalves, little crustaceans, shrimp-like things. And then on the surface of the mud, you might find some roaming sea cucumbers and brittle stars. Then occasionally there'll be some event on the seafloor and you'll get herds of cucumbers. I haven't seen a herd of cucumbers, but I've seen pictures of them and they're pretty extraordinary. So that's a kind of what I have in my mind is, in quotes, typical deep sea.
What I have in my mind now is an image of a herd of sea cucumbers. Not a phrase I ever thought I'd hear. The collective term for sea cucumbers aside, Cindy Lee Van Dover, CLVD, her answer to the question, what is down there, is, again, we don't know.
Yeah,
And we've looked at about 0.01% of the seabed.
It's mad, isn't it?
That is crazy.
Yeah, yeah. Apparently we've explored something like 5% of the ocean, which covers 70% of the planet.
Hmm.
And it is some, you know, ridiculously small amount of the seabed that we've actually got biological samples from.
We do know some of the stuff that is going on down there. I mentioned the anglerfish.
So there's a tendency for things to get much bigger when they're down in the deep sea. Nobody actually knows why. There's no biological theory for why we have these sort of giant monsters. But you get things like 12-foot spider crabs.
I mean, that's fantastic.
Can you imagine coming across one of those bad boys?
I'd be a mixture of excited and, I guess, a bit scared.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's a fish called the King of Herrings.
Uh-huh.
It exists in the deep ocean. It's an oar fish, and it's 12 metres long.
Oh, no. And is it I bet it's really pale as well.
Yeah, well, they're not good-looking things, are they, down there?
They don't need to be. It's so dark.
Yeah, well, presumably...
It's like dating in the dark.
Yeah, presumably...
Or getting eaten in the dark.
Presumably there's not a mating thing about looking good, though, is it? It must just be that they don't need to be symmetrical, or they don't need to be particularly sleek. Everything moves really slowly down there.
But there will also be a component which is above the sea. Mates are looking at prospective partners.
Yeah.
And lots of them have, you know, impressive sort of plumage or coats or whatever.
Yeah.
to show off.
Yeah.
And there's really no need for that down the bottom of the ocean. So you can just be saying, oh, listen, I promise you, I am super fit.
Your offspring, yeah, they're going to be gorgeous.
I mean, you'll never know.
Try and keep away from the light of that anglerfish.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. There is a certain amount of light from this kind of bioluminescence.
Yeah, yeah, lots of these creatures have genes that encode proteins that will then create light, and you use them as lures.
Yeah, It's quite good. And there's a lot of that kind of predatory life down there. It's not just anglerfish, is it?
No, no. There's deep sea sharks. Apparently, there was a great white that was eaten in 2003, and they think it was eaten by an even bigger, like a super shark.
So, what, it just sort of come up? Well, they sort of met in the middle.
Just come up.
The great white went a bit too deep. The big old shark from the bottom came up a bit.
It's terrifying, isn't it? And there's a thing called the colossal squid, which is like 14 metres long.
Yeah, I've actually spent more time than I should have done online looking at videos from submersibles that have caught glimpses of these enormous squid. Very, very enjoyable. I mean, they are mental looking.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, that's, I guess, the appeal of the deep sea, isn't it? It is this alien world, isn't it? Nothing looks like the stuff that we're used to looking at.
Hmm. This enormous shark that has maybe eaten a great white, how big is it and what does it look like?
Nobody knows.
Does it look like a megalodon?
No, but the goblin shark looks pretty like a dinosaur. I mean, it's a nasty-looking creature. Look that one up, a goblin shark. Just hideous.
I like an ugly animal, so I wouldn't hold that against it, really.
Okay. It's just, all
just,
yours.
Just so you know. You mentioned that everything's quite slow-moving. Why is that?
There's not a lot of energy available
down
there.
Because it's so bloody cold.
It's cold and dark. That actually limits, you know, how much life you can have down there.
Okay. One thing that I should mention is that Cindy, CLVD, is the first and only woman to have piloted the SS Alvin.
Whoa.
Yeah, you heard me.
It's the classic submersible, isn't it? It's the
primo submersible. Could you handle a submersible mission, Michael? Given
not
you're
keen.
At,
I'm not
of course
keen.
You're not.
No.
There's one thing I'm learning, and it is the only thing I'm learning, it's that you are not a fan of the deep sea.
No.
Or even the shallow sea.
I am very much for the surface and the land, and the bit where the surface of the water meets the land. I'm very happy and comfortable
there. Oh, you
love
the beach, don't you?
I do love a beach. But going down on these things, all I would be thinking is, it doesn't take a lot for this window to crack, or, you know, what if there's a bolt loose and the pressures you're dealing with down there.
What if
you're dead as soon as something goes wrong. That's my big problem with it.
But it's curiosity. You love space. There's no real reason to be looking out there.
So space I could deal with somehow. That's
what?
I know. I'm not saying it's rational, but I'm saying that I hate the idea of being deep under the ocean, where I sort of think, if anything goes wrong, I'm going to die straight away.
Yeah, definitely not true in space.
Well, it's more of an engineered environment. Somehow, I don't know, it just feels like it feels safer in space.
You're coming across as a lunatic. I don't mind it. Now, much as you're down on it, though, Michael, the deep sea does offer something a bit more substantial in terms of, like, the bigger picture. It could offer an answer to the origin of all life on Earth. I mean, that's a big deal, isn't it?
It is quite a big deal.
I'll tell you who thinks so. Professor Cindy.
Very soon after the discovery of hydrothermal vents, so this is back in the 1970s, late 1970s, the scientists involved in those early cruises recognized they have been around since the oceans were created and there was volcanism on the planet. And our eyes were open to this idea of chemosynthesis. We hadn't realized that microbes could use these compounds that normally we think are toxic and actually love them and chew on them as their you know, favorite dessert. And that just opened up thinking about how life might have originated on Earth and whether where life might exist on other planets. And because when we were exploring Mars for life, we were looking for photosynthetic life. But here's life that can exist without sunlight and even without oxygen if you're looking for particular kinds of bugs. The other thing about these systems is that they're not equilibrial systems. They're constantly changing. They're very dynamic. So they're not just steady state. And if you're going to originate life, it seems like that kind of system is what you'd like. You have every kind of chemical condition and temperature condition and pressure condition that you might need to have different kinds of early prebiotic chemistry.
Go on then, what do you reckon?
Well, it's a good possibility, definitely. It amazes me that scientists until 1977, which is when we discovered hydrothermal vents, you know, people didn't have the wherewithal to think that maybe all life isn't just like the life that we've seen on the surface of the planet. So you get this, you know, this magma coming up, meets the seawater, you get all kinds of chemical reactions able to occur at these points, and you know, things get trapped in the nooks and crannies of the rock, so you get these strange chemical concentrations and combinations.
So it's like quite a good lab space for life to be developed.
Yeah.
What are the other theories on origins of life? competing.
So one of them is that it actually came here from other planets, panspermia, the idea that, you know, it just arrived on meteorites or, mm-hmm. you know, the kind of the building blocks at least. Mm-hmm. And then there's the idea that it was in the sort of tidal zones where you, again, you've got this movement of water and the rocks and the chemistry kind of was there, and you'd need some kind of zap, you know, so a lightning strike on the right thing might have, you know, kicked the whole thing off.
It's but, quite dramatic, isn't it?
Yeah. But to be honest, we don't really know how life started.
I guess what I find interesting is that actually there is a kind of parallel between the deep sea and space in that they're both just so alien and so unknown, and to such an extent that NASA and oceanographers will collaborate sometimes.
Yeah, so, I mean, yeah, she mentioned this sort of thing about looking for life on Mars, and in 76 we sent up these probes to look for life on Mars and didn't realise that bacteria could survive in all these odd circumstances. And, you know, these bacteria that actually love these kind of weird environments. And since then we've discovered that, you know, there are bacteria that survive and thrive in nuclear power stations and stuff. And so NASA has realised that actually if it wants to understand what alien life might be like on, you know, icy moons of Jupiter or whatever, then probably the best thing to do is to look at what's going on under the ocean to get an idea of the scope and range of what kind of life there is.
So here's a big question for you, Michael. If it came down to it and you had a straight choice, would you rather find out the origins of life or the theory of everything? So would you unify Einstein's stuff with quantum or would you find out where life came from?
If I had a guaranteed in on the origin of life, I think I would go for that.
Would that surprises me?
Yeah,
because I thought you'd be all over the theory.
No, because I can still work on that. But actually,
so you still rate yourself? Yeah, give yourself a chance.
So my feeling is, you know, the problem with the origin of life we've got is that we only have one. You know, it's like we've got a sample of one. It's almost impossible to know exactly what happened. And you can have all these theories, but very, very difficult to test them. If somebody was going to give me that answer on a plate, I would take that. And then I would go away and say, okay, that one's solved. Let's concentrate on the theory of everything, because I think we can do that.
Yeah, nice approach. I like it. So let's recap our questions. So the first one was, how deep can we go? So the record is 332 metres, but if we can crack liquid breathing, we could go much, much deeper.
Yeah, but, you know, the deepest part of the ocean is 11,000 metres. I'm not up for going down there.
Well, yes, you've made that abundantly clear. And the second question was, but can we liquid breathe, Michael?
Not yet. So what you'd need to do is have a way of cycling the liquid so that you got the carbon dioxide out as fast as you needed to do, which involves something like 10 litres per minute or something if you're active. So you've got to have this sort of circulation of fluid really, really fast in order to get rid of the waste products. As soon as we crack that, yeah, we're in. Or you're in, I'm not.
Yeah, yeah. You're just holding me under, aren't you? Like a cat.
It'll be fine, Rick.
I'm just desperately fighting my gag reflex. Yeah, looking forward to that. And the third question was, what is down there? All sorts of great stuff.
All sorts.
And lots of stuff that we just don't know about.
Yeah. Scary stuff and known unknowns. Can we call them that?
Yes, we can. Yeah.
Yeah. Amazing monsters, probably. Not wet aliens, though.
No.
With it's big fiberglass city that they then bring out of the sea at the end.
Almost, though.
Nonsense.
The stuff that is down there, that's more exciting to me.
Oh, yeah.
Than a fiberglass alien city.
Yeah, yeah. Stupid glowing aliens.
Deep core, this is Cav 1, over. I'm not getting any answer. And we're flooding like a son of a bitch.
Yeah, you noticed?
No, you did okay back there, Virgil. I was fairly impressed.
Yeah, well, not good enough. We're still gonna catch big geek.
Yeah, well, not in this thing. Deep core, this is Cav 1, over.
Try it again.
Deep core, this is Cav 1, we need a... Over!
Science-ish is a Radio Wolfgang production presented by me, Rick Edwards, and Dr. Michael Brooks. The producers were Hannah Walker-Brown and Max Sanderson. The researcher was Cormac McAuliffe. This episode featured Dr. Oliver Firth, Professor Thomas Schaefer, and Professor Cindy Lee Van Dover.
Well, that's that.
Yeah, wonderful.